Today's episode of Hidden Forces is made possible by listeners like you. For more information about this week's episode or for easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you listen to the show on your Apple Podcast app, remember, you can give us a review. Each review helps more people find the show and join our amazing community. And with that, please enjoy this week's episode. What's up, everybody? My guest today is Rana Faruhar. Rana is global business columnist and an associate editor at the Financial Times. She is also CNN's global economic analyst and one of the more knowledgeable and intelligent guests I've had on this program. This is a phenomenal conversation. It hits right in my sweet spot. And where I think this show dominates the competition, and that is at the intersection of technology, finance, and culture, including a 40-minute overtime focused primarily on the financial side of this story, including a conversation about the overall macroeconomic picture, the revival of populism among Western countries, and the real prospects that a splinter net could emerge not only between the U.S. and China, but also between the U.S. and its Western European allies. We're living in one of these dramatic periods of societal change and uncertainty that most generations never get to experience. And I think it's being driven primarily by a very particular set of internet-enabled technologies that are currently undergoing a rapid phase of consolidation, something we haven't seen since at least the late 19th century. And this was a period where people's relationships to nature and to the land were being radically reshaped by the railroads, by industrial capitalism, urbanization, their sense of time and space, their relationships to their communities and to each other were being profoundly reordered. And this produced an unprecedented amount of anxiety. And like today, it coincided with a rise in populism and calls for heavy-handed regulation of what had become industrial monopolies that were able to set prices and use anti-competitive tactics to bankrupt their competitors to the point where if you were an independent oil refiner, you had to sell to John D. Rockefeller because he not only got preferential rates on his oil shipments, but he was getting rebates from the railroads on every barrel shipped by his competitors. And these types of anti-competitive practices were going on across the board in steel and tobacco everywhere. And it took a long time for the public to catch up and for journalists like Ida Tarbell to emerge, who could begin to bring a necessary level of clarity to what was happening. And I think this is where we are today. And people like Rana and Shoshana and other journalists and authors are beginning to take this on in a way that we haven't seen before. And I think it behooves all of us to pay attention because the battle lines of 21st century capitalism and liberalism are being radically redrawn. And if we want to have a say in what this world looks like and our place in it, we need to participate. And that starts with educating ourselves and others about what's going on and how we can start to fix it. And with that, please enjoy my very timely and very important conversation with Rana Faruhar. Rana, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great having you here. So I read your book, loved it. We'll talk about it. But you opened the book with a quote from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And I couldn't tell whether you were talking about big tech or the book or
my own family.
See, there's that too, or both. So why did you choose to open the book with a quote from an early 19th century sci-fi horror novel?
Well, I couldn't think of anything that better encapsulated what I felt I had learned at the end of doing this book, which is, you know, the book is kind of a 20-year history in some ways of how Silicon Valley, and in particular the big tech platform firms, went from utopia to dystopia. And they started with these incredible ambitions to connect the world, don't be evil, you know, it's a Google mantra. But by the end, and we're not even there yet, but we are where we are, you know, 20 years in, we've got election manipulation, we've got cognitive capture, we've got attention merchandising, we've got surveillance capitalism. And so there are so many negative externalities here. And I know, having spoken to some of the creators of these firms, that they're very torn. You know, they may not say so when they're sitting in Capitol Hill, but they are torn. And I think they're just beginning to realize, and we are all just beginning to realize, what the costs have been. And that's essentially what Shelley was getting at. You know, what started as this dream of life became a monster.
So what got you interested in this?
In the topic?
Yes.
So two reasons. About 3 years ago, I was starting my new gig as the global business columnist for the Financial Times. And my mandate was to write the world's biggest and most important economics and business stories in commentary form. So to do opinion pieces. And whenever I start a new position like that, I always like to follow the money and see, you know, where am I going to throw my energies? Where's the money? Where's the power? And as I dug into the numbers, it was really interesting. I began to see that a lot of wealth and a lot of political power had moved in the last decade from Wall Street to Silicon Valley. And that turn was already happening. But if you think about the timing, you know, 2007, the smartphone, 2008, financial crisis, a lot of regulation on the street. What industry was rising? Tech. It actually took the markets back up over that time and now maybe leading them down. But the other thing that happened, and this was really the thing that kind of drove me to do this book, a few weeks into that job, I come home one day and I open up my credit card bill and I look at it and there's all these odd charges like $1.99, $3, $5. And I look at them and I start adding them up and it's over $900 in charges. And I think, oh my God, I've been hacked. And then I start to look more closely and I see they're all from the App Store. And then I think, I don't buy that many things from the App Store. Who else has my password? My then 10-year-old son, Alex. So I go downstairs and, you know, Alex is parked in his usual after-school position, which is on the couch with his phone. And, you know, it takes me a minute to get his attention away from the phone. It's being he's playing something. And I start to quiz him about what's happened. And as I dug in, it was really interesting. I realized that something had overtaken him. He had gotten into a game, as it turned out, a soccer game, one of those games where it's offered for free. And I put that in quotation marks. You can download the game for free. But then as you're playing, you know, you want to buy a better player. You want to get Ronaldo a pair of cool new shoes, whatever it is. You start buying things in the course of the game. But you don't necessarily realize, especially if you're a 10-year-old, that you're buying things. And so little by little, as a measure of just how addicted he was to this game, he had spent in the course of a month over $900.
Wow.
I mean, you know, he was pretty high in the rankings, but come on.
Wow. You
know? So, but what the thing that was really, really interesting to me is that he's a pretty good kid. He's pretty good about asking for permission, but he had not really realized this rabbit hole that he was going down. He was kind of in a fog. And so I became horrified as a mother, and needless to say that, you know, his phone was confiscated and rules were set down, but I was fascinated as a journalist and I thought, I got to understand this business model.
So you touched on a few things there with your comment on your son. You're really touching on the behavioral levers. We had Shoshana Zuboff on the show.
Oh,
we
yeah.
talked about this at length, but let's actually roll back a little earlier and talk a bit about this comparison to Wall Street in 2007 with where we are today. We also had your managing editor, Jillian Ted, on the program.
Oh, yeah.
And we talked about this and how for years, Jillian's been saying this, that she has felt like Silicon Valley resembles or has started to resemble or feels a lot like Wall Street pre-crisis.
Yeah.
Can you flesh out that comparison a little bit? How did we get here? Because Silicon Valley, they were the darlings.
Yeah.
These guys, you worked in the dot-com bubble in 98.
I'm
you worked
old
for
enough.
A company,
yeah.
right, and in London. So I'd love to hear about that. But these were, back in the late 90s, I mean, this was like the place to be. And even in the early 2000s, and then even after the crisis, there was a kind of sense that these are the real entrepreneurs. This is where real business is happening.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are going to save us.
Mm-hmm.
And now everyone hates them.
Yeah.
So how did we get here?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. Let me take that in kind of three parts. So at the very most micro level, Jillian's actually right. If you look at transactions, there's a lot of asymmetry in financial transactions. And she wrote about that famously before the crash, her book about Fool's Gold, about the CDO crisis, and the amount of asymmetry in information on either side of a transaction. You can argue there's even more asymmetry in this new data capitalism that we're all a part of. Because if you think about it, let's go back to Adam Smith, you know, father of modern capitalism. He would have said that we need three things to have a properly functioning market: equal access to data, transparency in terms of what is actually being traded, and a shared moral framework. Now, you could argue that none of those things are in operation really in any kind of data transaction that you're making right now. And that's because data doesn't have a set value, at least that we know about. It does to the big tech firms, and they'll layer it in ways that create exponentially more value. You have no idea what one transaction that is surveilled by a big tech firm is worth, what 10 that are piled together, what your search patterns plus your GPS data plus what smart devices may be tracking you or what sensors are watching you across the street, what that's worth to Google. It's worth a lot. We're actually starting to see some numbers on that, and we can talk about that later. But that's point number one. So a lot of asymmetry, totally unregulated. I mean, you know, if you think that derivatives were unregulated before the crisis, big tech is completely unregulated. Point number two is these institutions have become, in some ways, I think, the new too big to fail institutions. And I'll explain why. I have a whole chapter in my book about this. As I said, early in my time at the financial crisis, I started looking at how wealth and power had shifted from the street to the valley. And then I started looking at, wow, what are all these cash-rich firms doing with that cash hoard? I mean, think about it. You know, Apple was interestingly the first chapter of my last book, which was actually about the
makers and takers.
And it's funny, in that book, I was trying to talk about how financialization had become a real issue in our economy, that financial markets had become the tail that wags the dog. And so business was really being led by finance instead of the other way around. And I wanted to try and find the most Kafkaesque example I could of how a company was interacting with the financial markets in a way that was just distorting, unproductive, unhelpful. And what I thought of was back in, I think it was 2014 or so, Apple had a ton of cash. I mean, it still does, but it had about $250 billion on its balance sheet at that point. It was 10% of all of America, corporate America's liquid reserves. I do remember
that.
Was
that around the time that Carl Icahn was rattling the cage
for
a dividend?
Carl Icahn was rattling the cage, and every time Carl would tweet, the share price would go up, and Tim Cook, who had had dinner with him in his home, and you know they had gotten to be buddies, was handing back money. And I thought, this is insane. I mean, for starters, why is this tweet not market manipulation? But then I started thinking, well, why are these buybacks not, and these dividend payments in the way that they're being done, not market manipulation? Because this is essentially paying out the top 10% of the country that owns 80% of the stock. This company hasn't actually needed to come to the financial markets for operating capital since the early 1990s. Is this what our markets are for? So that huge tech companies can issue tons of debt at really cheap rates, then park their own profits in overseas bank accounts where they're not taxable, at least not at the current rates in the US, and we can get into the Trump tax cuts and some of what's happened to that cash hoard since. And that's happening within an industry that one could argue every part of it that's really important was taxpayer funded. The internet, GPS, touchscreen technology. Think about that. That all came out of the Pentagon. It came out of DARPA. And this is what we've got. So I looked more deeply at that phenomenon in this book. And what I found was that basically 80% of corporate America's wealth was living in the top 10% of firms that had the most data, the most IP. The bulk of their cash hoard was in overseas bank accounts, not in cash, but in bonds, corporate bonds. And so they had become, in some ways, underwriters, unregulated underwriters. I mean, Google and Apple were buying up corporate issuances in the same way Goldman Sachs would have, sometimes, you know, 30% of a new offering, but we had no idea what was going on. And that just struck me as, wow, there is a new too big to fail industry. You know, if we think Wall Street has still got problems, this industry is incredibly opaque and nobody knows about it.
So you mentioned a lot of things just now.
Sorry, it's fine.
There's so much I want to talk about. These types of conversations are challenging because you're right in my sweet spot.
Awesome.
You know, it's like
Love
both
it.
Of the areas that I'm most interested in talking about, technology and finance and also culture. So two things you mentioned that stuck out to me. One is that the markets have become a mechanism for transferring wealth.
Yes.
Right? And it's a positive feedback loop and it's generating larger and larger amounts of inequality. And in a sense, that is being reflected in our politics.
100%. And actually, you're touching something. I said that there was a third part to that question about how is Silicon Valley like Wall Street. If you think about Wall Street as the purveyor of a kind of economic neoliberalism, the idea that capital can go wherever it wants to go, that's usually where labor's the cheapest. You know, that creates a lot of great things, but it also creates tremendous inequality. And it's one of the reasons we have the politics that we do, because you have these intense pockets of pain in certain countries because of the dislocation of jobs. Well, Silicon Valley puts that on steroids. So if you think about capital being able to fly over the problems of the nation state, data can do that even more easily. And so I think about a company like Facebook as almost the apex of neoliberalism. And I think a lot about this battle between Zuck and Elizabeth Warren. And I almost think of it as, I mean, he's right when he says that she's an existential threat, not just to breaking up Facebook, to the entire economic order that it represents.
Mm. So we've gone from hot money to hot data.
There you go.
That should be your third book,
Hot Data. Hot Data. I like it. I like that title.
So one is that wealth transfer. We can go down that rabbit hole for hours. And another thing you mentioned is Janeway's innovation economy. You mentioned we had Bill on the show as well.
Yeah, he's so great.
And we talked about this, absolutely. And, you know, to even be more specific, it's not that the government created the internet. It's that the government seeded the internet.
That's a good way to put
it. The government made the funds available to invest in what was otherwise an uninvestable proposition, something that would have been so expensive, wrought with so much risk.
Yes.
And the other thing that Janeway talks about is that the private sector is seeking to exploit and monetize as much of this existing technology as possible, but that you're not seeing that other transformational technology, and that there is a role for the state as an investor in the early stage of the economic cycle, of the innovation cycle, where risk is fraught and where the private sector is unwilling to make those investments.
100%. And it's interesting. I got interested in Janeway because I heard him speak several years ago at an INET conference. And he was digging into the idea of big tech's role in inequality. And back then, that was still just a kind of a mind-boggling idea, right? I mean, these were the innovators. These were the job creators. Heresy. You know, how could you? But he really got me thinking. And then I dug a little deeper and I started reading people like Mariana Mazzucato, you know, who makes the point very smartly in her own work that, look, there are different ways of doing this. If you're Danish, if you live in Israel, these countries actually take stakes in the things that they support with taxpayer dollars.
We didn't even take a stake out of the companies we bailed out.
Well, exactly.
Right. So, I mean, even in that case.
We need another podcast.
No, in that case, we actually, on top of that, we paid them twice.
Right, exactly. No, I mean, it's kind of unbelievable. And it gets to, I mean, you know,
regulatory capture, all sorts of stuff.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And also this mythology, this American mythology of bootstrapping. I mean, listen, you know, we were talking earlier, like you, I'm the child of immigrants. I believe in bootstrapping. But the idea that we're all in it alone all the time is a false narrative. And it's killing us. You know, it's going to kill the system if we're not careful.
I feel like, though, part of the resurgence of that narrative came out of the failures of the government. What we saw in 2008 was a larceny, right? What we saw was the system grinding to a halt and the power behind the throne stepping in front of the throne and saying, okay, we're going to save the system. And now since we're here, actually, we're going to get a little greedy and we're going to actually like, just really rape you.
Yeah.
You know, well, so people saw that.
That's right.
And I think, among other things, the rise of this type of ideological framework became more popular because people were like, well, screw the government. The government's not here to protect me. The government's here to rape me. The government's here to take my wealth.
Yeah. And I think maybe more particularly screw the elites.
Which,
you know, folks, I think one of the things I'm fascinated by is when you talk about the big tech regulation push, it's far left and far right. There's a lot of people that see, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, Jamie Dimon, Larry Summers, you know, whoever you want to throw into the basket, the kind of Silicon Valley, Wall Street, Washington Beltway as being all part of the same group of elites that they feel sold them down the river, didn't care about their interests, are part of a rigged game that they're never going to be able to engage in. And I actually think that we're moving. I mean, we've already moved from Occupy Wall Street to Occupy Silicon Valley. And those guys, particularly if you see a progressive Warren government, I think that the tax issues are going to change dramatically. The ability of them to monetize debt, the way in which the business model is conducted is going to just change dramatically. And that's going to lead to a big correction, I think, in valuations.
I want to talk about that too. In fact, we've got a real issue here, Rana, which is that I put together a rundown, but then this morning I saw your appearance on CNBC and it got me thinking about how I want to talk about SoftBank and WeWork and Uber and some of these Ponzi schemes that exist in financial markets today, Alibaba. So we're going to do our best. But what you touched on there was in the book, you talked about how that you believe that curbing Silicon Valley's nefarious side effects will become the signature economic issue for lawmakers over the next 5 years.
Yeah.
We had a crisis in 2008, right? The markets melted down. We hit 666 on the S&P. And even then, we didn't get the type of regulation that people expected, and we certainly didn't get fairness in the bailout.
Yeah.
Right? What do you mean when you say that? Are you saying that we're going to get real progress in terms of regulating Wall Street? And what's that regulation going to look like? I've heard another interview you gave on the way over here where you said if you could have your perfect candidate, you would merge Andrew Yang and Elizabeth Warren into one.
Yeah, get their brains together, maybe.
It feels to me like part of the problem is that I don't see anybody that's really addressing this coherently because Andrew Yang doesn't want to regulate them. Andrew Yang wants a dividend because he wants more money to the inputs, to the behavioral inputs into the surveillance capitalist model.
I'm so glad that you asked about that and I didn't have time to flesh out. But what I mean to say is that I want someone like Yang who understands enough about the technology and the subtleties that he's not going to make a statement like, just break him up, which is more a slogan than a solution. I love Elizabeth Warren. You know, I think the world of her. I think she's got her heart in the right place. But nobody, including Warren, has a 360 view on how regulation is going to ping pong around. And we can talk about that because there are things we could do that would address the financial issues. There are things we could do that would address the monopoly issues, but then they can have side effects in things like national security, in privacy, in civil liberties, in First Amendment. You need, one of the things I recommend in my book actually, is a task force of the smartest people, independent, to sit down with, you know, a short time frame, not forever, but a year, 18 months, and at least make a playbook of what are the issues and what are the possible externalities when you start to move one lever. I mean, we really need to do that. And it can be done. Europe has gone, and France in particular, has gone some way towards doing this. But what I like about Elizabeth Warren is that she takes on the power aspect of this. And power is the commonality between what happened in 2008 and what's happening now. The reason I'm more worried, and I think it's actually a bigger deal now, is that we're talking about an entire economic system. So back then, we were talking absolutely an important deal. The financial system melts down. Our taxpayer dollars are used to bail it out. That's huge. But we knew what was happening. We knew what the solutions were. I think we made the wrong bet. We didn't ask the private sector to take any pain. Right now, we're dealing with not just the business model of the FANGs, but everybody's business model. Data surveillance is, you know, Starbucks knows plenty about you. J&J knows about you. John Deere knows, you know, maybe not so much about you, but a lot about cabbages.
We've talked about John Deere here as well.
Yeah. No,
yeah, and so, that's also a threat in terms of cybersecurity.
So that fact, this is everybody's business model. It is, as Shoshana would say, a new kind of capitalism. That fact just exponentially increases the urgency. And at the same time, and we haven't even gotten to my chapter on the Uberization of everything, the nature of these firms and the way that they invest and create jobs or don't create jobs is so different than firms of the past. So you look at a company like Facebook or WhatsApp, that's the famous example that everybody uses. You know, the market caps are huge, as big as some of the last generation of tech firms, but they create a fraction of the jobs. And same again, if you look at the industrials of the past. So that disruption, that model is coming. That's going to crunch white collar jobs so much. I mean, you can't even believe the amount of investment that is going into software now. Long term, if we had the right education plan in place, that would be a net gain. But in the short term, there is going to be broad and deep job dislocation of a kind that if we think that out of work steel employees or truck drivers are upset now, man, just wait until the middle classes, the upper middle classes start to, you know, feel this pain. And I think we're going to have a real revolt.
So many things to talk about. You know, just to follow on the point about WhatsApp, another great example that I've used on the program before is Kodak and Instagram.
Yeah.
Instagram got bought out the same year that Kodak went bankrupt.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. So your point is that the way that money is made today, you can scale. You can scale off a very small number of employees and shareholders or partners or whatever, and you can capture that market.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a winner-take-all phenomenon. When you shift from an economy that is run on tangibles, widgets, things you can touch and feel, to an economy based on intangibles, it becomes easier to create a network effect, become big, eat everybody else's lunch. You're also needing to put less capital investment into the ground floor, onto Main Street. And that's one of the interesting things. You know, remember Trump's tax cuts a couple of years ago? We were all told, hey, we're going to give the big tech companies a lower rate. They're going to bring all this money home. They're going to invest it. Well, for starters, they put it in share buybacks. But the fact is, they don't have to invest as much as you would invest to, say, build a new factory. I mean, the entire nature of capital investment in the economy changes. And so that's changing, you know, I could go on, that's changing the Fed's calculations about interest rates. That's changing how we think about productivity. We are in a new world in which the main resource is data. And if we don't find a way to divide the pie of that new world up more equally, we're in for a world of political pain.
So kind of, you touched on this before, you touched on it again, the point has to do with barter.
Yeah.
It's the fact that a lot of value is being transacted, but it's not being priced.
That's right.
And that in order for economies to function properly, a capitalist system to function, you need to have prices. We have had an imperfect capitalist system for years because things like the environment are not priceable in many cases. And so we end up exacting costs onto our environment that we wouldn't otherwise if they were priceable. It seems that we've been going in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And that kind of brings us to a point about industrialization, where people went from being people to being labor to now being inputs.
Absolutely. Or the raw material. I mean, it's amazing. It really is like you're living in the Matrix, you know?
We talk about the Matrix on this show a lot. It's religion
true.
On this show.
Really? Oh, my God. It's so true, though. I mean, it's prescient. It's
very prescient.
We are the raw material, and our own patterns, our behaviors, our thoughts are being studied, analyzed, and then sold back to us.
So, a number of things. One, when you were saying this is even worse, this is worse than the financialization, worse, this sort of datization, you have a great quote in the book, and it fleshes out one side of why I agree with you. You write, one of the reasons that it's tough to tackle the challenges wrought by big tech is that we spend so much time being distracted by it.
100%.
One of the things I often think about is the automation, and I don't mean it in the way that most people think about automation. I mean that we live in a world where more and more of our lives happen automatically.
Mm.
We just assume things will work.
That's true.
Our car will work. If it breaks, we don't know what to do.
We certainly
can't fix it. And the average Joe engineer on the block can't fix it. You need to have computers to fix these things. If you get lost or if your phone goes down, you don't know how to get home in many cases. So, I mean, it's the same sort of phenomenon of pilots who don't have enough flight time who are relying on the automatic pilot, the autopilot. And then when the autopilot goes down, what do?
It's such a deep thing. You're making me think about Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I don't know if you've ever
read
that.
I have not, but I've heard it's a great book.
It's really right in that area from a philosophical standpoint. It's also very, you know, what you're saying is kind of Marxian, you know? It's like we are in this sort of capitalist cycle where we're becoming more and more dislocated from the means of production. Mm. But what you're talking about is very true.
Except we're being dislocated from ourselves. We're being pulled apart, right?
Indeed. And, you know, we're in an attention economy. This is a term that was coined by Tim Wu, who's, you know, at the sort of forefront of thinking about ways to regulate this, the Columbia Law professor. To get back to your point about why technology's distractions are making it hard to solve the problem, let me give you a little example that I've been thinking about a lot. One of the things that I talk about in my book is that, and you may already know this, but in 1998, when Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the founders of Google, wrote their initial paper about search, they did that at Stanford. It's online. Anybody can read it. There's an abbreviated version, and then there's a longer version that's, you know, over 30 pages. And of course, as I was researching this book, I sat down and read the entire thing. Well, I get to almost the end in the appendix section, and there's a two-paragraph section on advertising and its discontents. And it basically lays out exactly where we are. The guys say, okay, we've now told you what the search engine is and how it will work. Now, how do you monetize it? One easy way would be through targeted surveillance, looking at people's personal data and then selling advertising against that. However, they concluded that that would create a diametrically different set of interests between companies and users, that companies could potentially mislead users, that even public entities could be misleading. I mean, they essentially predicted exactly where we are. And so that to me was a mind-blowing thing. I thought to myself, surely other people are talking about this. I've missed it. Somebody else has reported this. Some New Yorker writer has written the like long story of that two paragraph. No, guess why? Because people aren't reading. They're too busy tweeting journalists. You know, I mean, I'm stunned by the fact that sometimes all you have to do is show up and read the documents, but people don't do it anymore. And that's the tip of the iceberg. So how are we going to solve something like climate change when we're all busy interacting in 280 characters and children are now, as the latest Common Sense survey said, getting most of their, not just entertainment, but news from YouTube. I mean, my own son, I mean, think about this. He is in a household, divorced household, two very involved parents in both households, three journalists, one activist, highly educated. He will sometimes come home and talk about these facts he's heard online that are just so clearly fake news. And I think, what's happening here? That this is someone who is at the highest level of privilege and is being inculcated with these ideas through these new forms of media.
So it's actually really scary. And we've done a number of episodes on this. I did one where it's the only one I ever did where we didn't have a guest. And I put together a series of clips, including from The Matrix. And it was based on Theodore Kaczynski's paper, Industrial Society and Its Future, The Unabomber. And one of the things that I talked about and sort of that I want to bring up here is that, and Shoshana kind of touches on this when she talks about the unprecedented. You know, it's so unprecedented that we don't really understand what's happening.
Yeah.
We don't see how it's dramatically changing our lives and everything around us. Talk about the extent to which people are distracted. It's scary.
Well, it is. I mean, two or three thoughts there, just to dig down into the brain science for a minute. We're kind of at the beginning of this. There's not a lot of peer-reviewed work, but what we're seeing is that brain patterns are being changed. Our ability to concentrate is being lowered. College professors, high school teachers are now complaining that kids can't come in and study the basic books. I mean, you know, you mentioned in the very beginning my quote from Mary Shelley. I just hope my kids will be able to, well, I know my daughter will make it through, but I hope Alex will be able to make it through Frankenstein. You know, the idea of doing 300 pages of reading is becoming a problem for kids. Now, some people would say, that's all right. You know, we've had these shifts in the past from print to television, or, you know, when there were comic books were new, everybody got kind of exacerbated about that. But I'm skeptical.
It's not the same thing because it's not one way. It's two way.
That's it.
There's two way communication there. And again, to bring up Shoshana, the whole point about predictive algorithms is that the best predictions you can make are the ones that you've already secured through your actions. If you guide the foot traffic on Pokemon Go to that restaurant, you can predict with 100% reliability that you're going to sell 50 pizzas today.
Yes.
Because you know, because you sent the traffic there.
Yeah.
And it's not that you're predicting the traffic's.
And talk about an asymmetry of information.
That's the thing. You mentioned it earlier. It's power. This is about power.
It's about power. And, you know, it's about free will.
It's about free will also.
Free will. Do we have free will?
So you, again, I'm jumping everywhere. I'm all over the place here. The papers are scattered.
I hope your readers won't mind.
Yeah.
Listeners,
they won't.
I mean,
I love this. I just want to make the best use of it. So you mentioned George Soros in the book, another trigger.
Yeah.
What's it called? Trigger warning, George Soros. Trigger warning.
Oh my gosh. I hope we don't lose half the readership
So he gave a speech at Davos in January 2018. He also gave one in 2017, and I think he gave one in 2019 as well. But there's an excerpt of that I pulled from your book, and he's explaining, for example, how big tech was divesting people of their autonomy. And he said that, quote, it takes a real effort to assert and defend what John Stuart Mill called the freedom of mind. There is a possibility that once lost, people who grow up in the digital age will have difficulty in regaining it.
Yes, I worry so much about that. I see such a difference, not only in my children, and And it's interesting, there's a difference, possibly because of their gender, but also their age. I have a daughter who's 17 and a son who's now 13. Some of the early research is showing that tween and teen boys are amongst the most susceptible to being kind of pulled
Why
into-
is that? I wanted to ask you about that because I've seen the same thing.
Okay, so what I've been told, and again, I think we're at the beginning of this research, but what I've been told by some psychiatrists is that tween boys, if you think about it from an evolutionary standpoint, they're geared up to be out with dad, you know, hunting, shooting, learning about the world with a lot of quick action and reward or punishment, you know, quickly in repetition. So they're looking for high repetition, quick feedback and reward. That's exactly what you get online. The only other thing that I have found in my own life that even remotely replaces this is basketball for my son, the highest speed, you know, quick repetition, quick reward game. So I basically try and push him off now to the YMCA as much as I can.
I read
to keep
that in
him
the book. You
phone.
Put that in the book.
But that's what we think so far. We don't really know. I mean, teenage girls are being affected too. Many of them are, of course, prone to depression and anxiety. Those levels, interestingly, in recent years had been tailing off. And now they're coming back, which is something that Jean Twenge looks at in her book, iGen, which I quoted and is also a great read. Again, pretty new research, but what we're seeing is that social media in particular is, she likens it actually to alcohol, to a glass of red wine. Maybe one drink is good for you because maybe you don't want to be the only teetotaler at the party and, you know, there's some antioxidants and that's good. Okay, so you don't want to be the only kid without a phone. That makes you kind of an isolated weirdo, but the more you start to have that the second, third drink, the more hours that you spend with social media in this kind of bubble world where images are being perfected in this very unreal way, the more you start to suffer from things like anxiety, depression, girls are getting eating disorders, having self-harming behaviors. I was actually moderating a conference on this topic recently, and there were a bunch of kids there, high school and college kids, and during one of the breaks, one of the young women came up to me and said, you know, I feel weird about how I use my relationship with social media, that the other day it was my dad's birthday and I wanted to wish him a happy birthday, but I thought I didn't really want to post it. I just wanted it to be personal. But then I thought, if I do this and I don't post it, if I don't have a picture or something on my Facebook page, is it real? Did it really happen?
You know?
So that is mind-blowing. And to me, that gets at what you're saying, which is that this generation is being shaped differently.
So many thoughts. So also for listeners, Nicholas Carr, the author, has written a bunch of books on this, on technology and the brain. Sherry Turkle also
has. Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, she has.
She found, actually, you know, I spoke to her recently and some of her research is on empathy. She's doing a lot of work on how this changes how we relate to one another as human beings and how we actually empathize. She found that if I were to pull out my phone right now and put it on this table between us, that would automatically decrease the empathy of the conversation. And by empathy, I don't mean that I'm liking you. It means I'm looking to understand you and where you are. Can you think of anything more useful in our society today than trying to reach across the table and understand where someone else is?
Yeah. So in Alone Together, she actually gives a great scene when she's at the zoo and her daughter sees a turtle and she makes the point, like, it would have been better if they just had a robot. Like, why did they even have the regular turtle there? And she was sort of confused by that. It might have been her daughter or a girl that was next to her. But her book Alone Together is very good for listeners. We had Jonathan Haidt on the program. We talked about,
he's great.
He's also great. We talked about how social media is particularly harmful to girls. But this larger thing about gender is also problematic because we're at a period of time today where so many things are shifting, norms are shifting, or they're being questioned. And I just feel like people are losing their footing.
Yeah.
And even to have a conversation like what you're describing, you have to stereotype boys. And there are a lot of people that are going to tell you that's not okay.
I know.
So this is a big problem.
Well, this is why I want my daughter who's looking for colleges to go to University of Chicago, because it's like the last free speech safe space.
That's also, by the way, you know, you're a child of immigrants. So am I.
Yeah.
I find that we immigrant children or immigrants tend to be more normal when it comes to this stuff. You know, they're less, you know, just in the same way that Americans have a really screwed up relationship to food.
Yeah. Yes. Oh my gosh.
It's similar.
Yes.
It's similar. It's like, you know, but the larger kind of thing, you know, it's totally, that's
I
why
just
these
love
fad
that.
Diets.
I just love that you said that.
It's true, because Americans have these fad diets. And I think the research that I've read has a lot to do with the fact that there's no food culture kind of, you know, maybe in the South, there's more of a food culture, but I don't know how good it is because there's an obesity epidemic in some of the Southern states.
Yeah. No, but I see what you're getting at. I mean, I was not hothoused. I think that there's two trends that are intersecting, let's say. It's funny, I actually wrote a piece that I thought was very sensible, but got a lot of hate mail at the FT over a year ago on why supposedly liberal college campuses are so illiberal in terms of curbing, you know, conservative folks that come and speak. I mean, okay, somebody doesn't like it, you write a letter, you speak
too
out,
bad,
you know,
grow
I mean,
up.
You know, right. So anyway, that got a lot of hate mail, but that trend of a certain kind of, I would say, illiberal liberalism coming to universities is actually intersecting with the first generation of digital natives that are in this like multifaceted kind of mirrored funhouse world that is distorting and confusing and complicated. And really, I mean, if you go back in history, it's not unprecedented. Neil Ferguson, the historian, I actually quote his book, The Tower and the Square. He looks at disruptive technologies and their effect on society. And he talked a little bit in his book about the printing press and how, you know, when you had Martin Luther, you had everybody being able to read the Bible in their own language. You got a lot of great things eventually, but first you had 150 years of religious wars all over Europe. So we may be in that period right now.
That's an interesting analogy because, like the printing press, you were able to experience a dramatic shift in terms of your capacity to experience or learn,
yes,
independent of other people.
That's true.
You know, you were reading a text. And now I remember why I brought up the episode we did, 27, Industrial Society and Its Future. By the way, for listeners, we also did an episode, I think it was 66, called How the Internet Happened, where we talked about a lot of the things that Rana mentioned, specifically with Google, but with all lots of other companies. But one of the things I mentioned in that episode, Industrial Society and Its Future, was how you could be sitting in a railway car, mm-hmm, and every single person in that car is experiencing a completely separate reality than anyone else. You know, the simple example is that everyone has their own newspaper and each one of those newspapers is running its own advertisements and there are no rules and there has to be no relationship between one or the other. And I think, you know, we all sort of understand that intellectually. I just don't think, and then right back to Shoshana, who has written, I think, one of the best books of the current century, I have called it. When I read it, I was really blown away by it. I don't think that we understand really what that means, how profound that is.
Oh, it's huge. It is the post-fact world.
I mean, it is a social schizophrenia.
That's a great way to put it. I mean, the fact that you and I can search the same term and have different results depending on our patterns and our previous movements online is stunning. I mean, it creates, just as you say, completely different realities. I mean, sometimes I feel like a Luddite because I still read 3 papers in print every day, as well as a number of things online. But I'm pretty disturbed because I find, even in comparison to, you know, some younger people that I know in the business, I feel like I'm better informed because I'm just spending less time and that I have a more balanced view. I mean, that's one of the reasons I find myself writing these stories that I think are very normal, but then get these kind of far right or far left political reactions. We're all being pushed to the extreme in this schizophrenic world that you're talking about. And so it's fascinating. Actually, I recently wrote an article. There was some studies that were done on Republicans and Democrats and their perceptions of each other. And of course, as you would imagine, both sides had more extreme views about the other side than was warranted, right? You know, we're in these filter bubbles. You know, I live in Brooklyn. I can't tell you how many dinner parties I go to where people think that Republicans are just raving lunatics. And I'm like, I grew up in rural Indiana in a cornfield. Like, I know the Trump voter. They're my best friend from high school, you know? So, but what's interesting is, so why is this? They dug down and they found that the patterns really collated with the amount, first of all, of media consumption in general, but then, of course, of social media and kind of non-traditional forms of media. Even the New York Times read online was more polarizing than, say, you know, an old style network news program that's supposed to hit just to the middle. So this dynamic is polarizing even what we think of as conventional news sources. And the only solution really is to interact with each other. They found that the people that have the least bias are the ones that actually spend the most time with people from the other side. So it tended to be educated Republicans and, interestingly, uneducated Democrats. Elite Democrats were all sitting at their dinner parties.
That makes all the sense in the world.
Park Slope. And poor Republicans might be in talk radio filter bubble. But so, you know, talk about the need for empathy, real human communication, and we're losing it.
Wow. I mean, I can't tell you how much that last point resonates. I've had a few falling outs where I've just stopped talking to some people, and they're again, to your point, illiberal liberalism. It's not liberal.
No,
it's not. It's not liberal. Liberal means that you have tolerant.
That's right.
Yeah, they're intolerant.
That's right.
I've gone to a lot of these parties where there's like a litmus test. It's not even a litmus test. They just assume that you're going to agree with their political points of view. And if there's any divergence, there's like an awkward moment. Like, how do I handle this? No, I'm a person. I have lots of different views. And just because I don't toe every line, you
100%.
Know, doesn't make me...
It's so illiberal, and it's also incredibly anti-intellectual, which is another thing to worry about.
It is anti-intellectual. So two things I want to mention to listeners. Again, we mentioned Jonathan Haidt. The Righteous Mind touches on all the things Rana is talking about.
Great book.
In terms, absolutely. It helps explain so much about why people can dislike others so much whose views diverge from their own. Accountability is something I want to talk about, though, because... You talked about it in terms of anti-intellectualism. I think this is a huge problem. I think you especially are in a unique place, but both of us to some degree are in a unique position because we are forced to be accountable as a result of our profession. We can't just make stuff up. Actually, sure, I could make stuff up. I'm independent.
Right.
I don't work for the Financial Times. I could start making things up. And if I can monetize that audience, that works just fine. And lots of people actually do that.
Right. 100%.
But actually, I would be embarrassed. So accountability. People aren't accountable. And one of the things that drives me nuts, and this I think is actually more of a phenomenon on the right, I don't have any numbers to back it up, it's anecdotal, but I feel like the conspiracy theories, there's a larger panoply of conspiracy theories on the right and a willingness simply to indulge them. And I'll give a great example of one, in fact, that I think you have every right to believe in a conspiracy, but it's a perfect example. So when Jeffrey Epstein ended up murdered, because you write about this in the book, you write about your own particular reaction. My reaction was, wow, this is super suspicious, but I have no freaking idea what happened. I just heard something.
Yeah.
It's perfectly possible the guy killed himself.
Right.
And I saw a bunch of people just immediately going on social media saying that he was murdered and everything else. And I'm like, maybe.
Yeah.
But you have now lost all credibility.
Right.
Right? So like you have also biased yourself. You're not positioning yourself to confirm that bias. You're not actually trying to get to the truth.
Right.
This is a common problem, right? And so like, as this story goes on more and more, it looks like increasingly like there's some really bad shit happening. I don't know if you saw the ABC anchor, Robbie, what's her name? She's one of the anchors on Good Morning America. She was between takes. She was on set. Her mic was hot. And she was talking about how she and her producers had put together a story and they were sitting on it for 3 years. ABC would not run it.
They had
Bill Clinton. They had Prince Andrew.
Wow.
Yeah. Now I think that she later found out that, well, she knows she was probably being recorded because they record between takes. She probably looked at it with her producer, signed it off, and put it out there. It's probably a way to push the story.
Yeah.
But in any case, my point is, even something like Epstein, you guys shouldn't be talking out of your ass. If you don't know, don't say anything. You know, and I think that lack of accountability is a problem because it allows for this flourishing of so many conspiracy theories, alternative theories. But that brings us to another problem. Which is actually a twofold problem. One, again, is the technology, right? It is that there is not one consensus hallucination of what reality is. The Matrix, again, there is no real reality. Where do we get, is there a turtle shell at the bottom of that?
Yeah.
And the other point is that the official narrative, the state, has lost credibility. And Donald Trump's a great example of this.
Yeah.
Donald Trump pulled troops out of Syria, right? And what did the mainstream media do? Instead of focusing and saying, yes, the way that he did this was horrible, but we also have to admit our foreign policy is a disaster.
Yeah, yeah.
The Bush administration was a colossal disaster.
Yeah.
Obama's foray into Libya was a disaster. We pushed all this stuff.
You know, it's a really interesting question. You're making me think, this is slightly off topic, but I think maybe not. I was maybe a year ago getting ready to do a hit on CNN, the latest iteration in the U.S.-China trade issues. And right before, Trump hadn't given a press conference in a while, but he got off a plane and decided he was going to talk. So boom, you know, my hit's canceled, but I've still got my headset in. So I start listening, and I hadn't actually watched him on TV for a long period of time. He spoke for about 20 minutes. And I was blown away, not by the factuality of what he said, but the fact that he believed it himself. He was authentic to himself. And what I was thinking was, that's powerful to a viewer on television. And why does nobody write that? And so I wrote this article saying, this guy is a complete master at delivering messages, and we need to pay attention to this and quit dissing him for, you know, getting this or that wrong. Guess what? If you're a television viewer, you're watching emotional energy, you're watching body language, you're watching confidence, you're watching the animal instincts. I got kind of slammed for writing that piece.
Really? By commenters?
A lot of, you know, liberal, yeah, commenters. I mean, I'm a card-carrying Democrat.
They're terrified that you might be speaking the truth.
Well, it's just interesting. There's something about the current environment in which the lack of accountability, the polarization has somehow made it all the harder to tell the truth or to be anywhere in the middle. Being in the middle is really, really difficult these days, and it's exactly what we need.
So a lot of thoughts. I had Andrew Marantz on the show also recently.
Oh,
he came out with a book called Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians,
yes,
and the Hijacking of the American Conversation, Antisocial. And during the episode very early on, he said, this is what Donald Trump has done to us as a country. And I said to him, is that right?
Yeah.
Has Donald Trump done this to us? I think there is an echo chamber in leftist progressive media.
That gives him too much credit. Like, he's a symptom of a change that was happening.
It also doesn't take accountability.
Right.
Also, the media, this is another issue, unfortunately. We have a lot of hams in news.
That's true.
We have a lot of people that are just narcissists, and people hate them, understandably.
That's very true, actually. You know, it's funny. I worried a little bit about being a journalist writing a book that was very critical of big tech.
You were very critical in the book.
I was very critical.
You were critical. Also, you named names. You did not pull punches.
I didn't pull
Sandberg
punches.
Sandberg is one of them where you were very hard on her. I think completely in pure fairness.
Well, I think that I got to say, I think if she wasn't a woman, she'd be taking a lot 100%.
More heat. 100%.
A lot more heat. And I hear that there's a book coming out in the spring about her. I wonder what it's going to say. I mean,
a critical book or
I hear there's a critical book coming out in the spring.
Well, so, you know, of course, Shoshana calls her the Typhoid Mary of surveillance capitalism.
Yeah, mean, she's
which is a great name.
She's, you know, it is actually, that's the best analogy. I mean, I get so angry when I hear Zuckerberg, but particularly Sandberg on the Hill month after month saying, okay, yes, we're so sorry about this latest mishap, but we couldn't have possibly imagined. What do you mean you couldn't have imagined? You perfected the AdSense model at Google, and then you brought it and further tweaked it at Facebook. I mean, she's ground zero with all of this. And anybody that was there knows. I mean, Roger McNamee writes about this in his book, Zucked.
Zucked.
Yeah.
With a big thumbs up.
Great title. Yes, exactly.
They are so disconnected, right? It's like freakishly disconnected. I think you in your book mentioned Lloyd Blankfein's quote of, we're doing God's work.
Yeah.
Which I wasn't sure if he was joking.
He was totally joking.
Was he joking?
He was joking. They're not joking. That's the thing. You know, there was something in the papers recently about Sheryl standing up when somebody was attacking Mark, or not attacking, but being critical in the media about Mark, and saying, how can you do this to this kid? That kid was, first of all, like, put aside the Freudian mommy dynamics there, but like, this kid is a billionaire that is running a public company that is unaccountable because of a loophole from leftover from 1996. I mean, that's insane. You know, if I were a shareholder in that company, I would say that's a governance crisis.
Oh, that's the least of our worries.
Oh,
we should start talking about Tesla or SoftBank or something else. We'll talk about those things. But, you know, just to drive this point home, your managing editor, Gillian Tett, wrote a piece in the FT today where she talked about how Facebook, we're talking about a number of things, but Facebook has basically gone back on their promise to shepherd Social Science One, which should have been an academy industry project that promised to follow academics from across the world and give them access to private anonymized data from 2 billion Facebook users. But there was a quote that she made available in that article, and it was from a Facebook official. And she said, Making user data available for research on a large scale in a way that protects individual privacy is just incredibly hard. Maybe impossible. What bullshit? Of course it's not impossible. And you guys promised that you were going to make this available and you couldn't even do that. In other words, this brings us back to the point, Janeway's. Mm-hmm. And also, we did another episode to plug my show. I've been plugging it all day.
As you should.
Yes. Who else is going to plug
not
me?
That's right.
I have my cousin from, I'm Greek, as we said. All my family's in Greece. And I have my youngest cousin likes his own Facebook posts. And I go, what are you doing liking your posts? And he goes, if I don't like them, who will?
I love it. I'm very sympathetic to that attitude.
Yeah. Alexandros is his name. So that goes back to Sophie Bacall. We did an episode with Sophie Bacall on phase transitions, and we covered Vannevar Bush and the relationship between the government, the military, and academia, right? And we had a similar situation also with Bell Labs. And Facebook's not even willing to do that, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the question is, why do we believe anything at this point?
We don't.
That Facebook's
and isn't that the problem?
Yeah, it's 100%. I mean, this company has just a leadership crisis of a kind that I don't really know how they're going to come out of it at this point. I mean, definitely Zuck or Sheryl are going to have to go, one if not both. And I think that that's probably going to happen by 2020.
So I want to try and transition effectively here. There are a number of things I want to get to. The next thing that I want to try and connect here is to take it from what we've done so far, which is talk about big data as a primarily private sector phenomenon, and now attached to it, the state component. Mm-hmm. So already we know, for example, Amazon has strong ties to the surveillance state.
Yes.
Dwight D. Eisenhower was the first to talk about the military-industrial complex. It was actually originally the military-industrial congressional complex. It seems that we have something similar today with the surveillance economy.
Yeah.
Google also, Niantic Labs, Shoshana talks about this at length. Again, a book I highly recommend listeners read. I also want to say this. I do highly recommend Rana's book. I put it right up at the top of my shelf along with Shoshana's book and a number of other books.
Well, I'm honored
that
to
are
be
doing
in
a
that
lot
spot.
Of very good work in this area. Let's talk a little bit about this. I don't know much about who these players are. Yep. I think it's very scary that Amazon has so many relationships that we don't understand when Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of brings us, again, it's a way of talking about the unprecedented.
Yeah.
You know, these companies have become so big and so powerful so quickly.
Yeah.
And we were caught off guard. We don't really realize. In your research, can you flesh this out for me? What are we talking about here? How interconnected is the private sector of these big tech companies with the government?
Hugely interconnected. I mean, Eric Schmidt, the former CEO and chairman of Google, is sitting on a kind of semi-government board that is essentially creating digital defense policy. I mean, you know, he's running that. Amazon is the main purveyor for government procurement at this point. I mean, they do logistics for the CIA. They deliver documents. There's a lot of deep ties. But let me pull back for a minute because there's also a fascinating juxtaposition here. So we spoke earlier about how in some ways the biggest tech platform firms are the apex of the multinational corporation, the neoliberal capital data can go anywhere. They're completely supranational. I mean, if you think about it, Google is still operating a research center in China. You know, now would Raytheon be able to do that? I don't think so. But Google, with its AI division, is arguably more important for national security than any kind of old line maker of military equipment. Now, I don't know completely what the answers to these questions should be. But I can tell you one thing. This defense that big tech companies from Facebook to Google have given that we can't be touched, we can't be regulated, we can't be liable for any of the same kind of regulation as other companies because we're your national champions in the battle against China is beyond nationalistic. It's so cynical. You know, these are
that's
companies.
That's Zuckerberg's like go-to.
That's Zucker. I mean, that's, you know, that one of the
if
best
you regulate
moments.
Us, it's going to put our national security at risk.
China is going to take over. These companies would love to be in China. I'll tell you, the only reason Amazon is not playing the China card is that it can't get in because of Alibaba. So they've decided to go the other direction and say, we want to own everything to do with government procurement. What I'm concerned about is two things. First of all, it's a false narrative that regulation will somehow penalize America in the innovation battle with any big country from China to the European Union. Our advantage has always been decentralization. Our advantage has been allowing many, many different companies to grow and flourish. Unfortunately, what the statistics are showing is that for the last 20 years, as big tech has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, the number of innovators has gone down by a number of measures. You know, entrepreneurial zeal per capita. The Kauffman Foundation has done really great research on this. But basically, there's black holes now because these firms will come in and buy up anybody that they think is going to compete with them. There's a lot of research to show, Stanford research shows that innovation tends to slow down dramatically after a company goes public for obvious reasons. You know, smaller companies.
Look at Apple. It's a perfect example.
Totally.
What do they keep putting out? Higher resolution screens, fancier watches.
Cards.
It's a fashion company.
Exactly. Or a financial company.
It's a consumer electronics company. It's not doing anything interesting anymore.
So this is a false narrative that the Schmidts and Sandbergs and Zuckerbergs are putting forward. That's point number one. Point number two is that we are headed, like it or not, to a splinter net. I think that the US, Europe, and China, and some of the emerging markets that China is going to pull into its orbit via the One Belt, One Road infrastructure program, I think we are going fundamentally different directions in terms of how the digital economy is going to be regulated. Now, if we were smart on this, as in all things to do with trade, we would be really teaming up with Europe right now to say, all right, we are a liberal democracy, I hope, still, you know, let's talk to other people with this system and find out what the rules of the road should be. Let's come to some standards that we can both live with. Instead, we are embroiled in this false narrative put forward by the companies themselves, who, by the way, are now the biggest lobbying group in Washington. They have bought out so many regulators, so many academics who write about this topic, who do, you know, the amicus briefs that are being looked at by the courts in small print. You find out that they're Google consultants.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable.
Absolutely. We've talked about this as well on the program. We did a number of episodes on China. There's also something else, which is there's a historical, this again is part of the problem people don't read. I'm 100% with you. People should stay the hell away from news and try and read it only in a controlled manner.
Yes.
And not just like read whatever comes on their social media feed.
100%. Nassim Taleb, I don't know if you've ever had him on.
No, I would love to have Nassim on. I've actually reached out to him. He's a difficult person to get
a hold of.
He's
a
I would love to have him on.
He's not on email very much. He walks the walk.
I've been trying to get him on for years.
Well, you know, I interviewed him once way back when his last book was coming out. And he told me he didn't do any high-speed data, any high-speed media at all, that he read basically only books. And he had a stack of amazing books on his net.
So I actually have a thought about that as well. Quick interjection on it. And I don't want to get lost on the point, but I actually think that physical books will actually command a high resale value in the future, because I think people, or maybe not a high resale value, but they will come back into demand, because I think that people want a way to read without having their thoughts surveilled. I think
that'll be a
powerful thing. I wanted to kind of make a point before I move us to the overtime, Rana, and a couple of points. One is both of them steeped in history.
Yeah.
One is that we've seen this before, right? We've seen that when a technology becomes mature, there is a phase of consolidation. And we saw the regulation of heavy industry and the banking sector and everything else in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Certainly, the banking regulation didn't go as well as we would have liked. I think it was done much better after World War II. But regardless, something similar has to happen again and will happen. I'll also say something else, which touches on your point about China and these selfish companies that operate for their own private benefit. Fine. That's the way they've been built. That's the culture. But this idea that I should be more afraid of Xi Jinping than of Mark Zuckerberg.
Right. Exactly.
And it also, if you've read history, you know about IG Farben.
Yeah.
You know about IBM.
Yes.
IBM's role in supporting the Nazi killing machine with their punch cards, the DuPont family, the Rockefellers, the big banks supported Mussolini. They supported Francoist Spain. They supported the Nazis. They funded them all up until the Trading with the Enemy Act.
Yeah.
They continued to have relationships. I think IBM had relationships right through the end of the war with the Nazis.
This is such an important point. And you know, what you're calling to mind is the fact that Facebook hired this nefarious PR firm to go after George Soros. Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg are Jewish. This firm ended up using anti-Semitism to try and smear Soros. You know, I mean, there's no reason why we should think a large multinational corporation run by unelected people is any better than any other kind of large state monopoly, namely China. I mean, I actually think of big tech and China as being kind of similar in some ways.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, to bring it back to the Nazis, the Nazi regime, the fascist regime, and Mussolini's Italy also, of course, Mussolini pioneered this, the relationship between the public and private sectors was instrumental in enabling totalitarianism. To bring it back to George Soros, one of the other things that you quoted in his speech from Davos, he said that he feared, quote, alliances between authoritarian states and these large data-rich IT monopolies that would bring together nascent systems of corporate surveillance and an already developed system of state-sponsored surveillance, which is one of the things I want to talk to you in the overtime. I also do want to talk to you about, I mean, you have such a deep knowledge of financial markets. You've covered it for years and years. I want to talk about the macro picture, touch on it to the extent that we can. And I also do want to talk about SoftBank, Alibaba, WeWork, Uber, again, try to mix it in as much as we can. For regular listeners, you know the drill. If you're new to the show or you don't support us yet, you can head over to patreon.com/hiddenforces and subscribe to our audiophile, autodidact, or super nerd tiers and get access to this week's overtime, where I'm going to continue our conversation with Rana, as well as access to a transcript to this week's episode, as well as to my beautiful multi-page, 12-page rundown today, full of pictures, including a Frankenstein and Mary Shelley's.
Oh, that's so great. I love that we can download all that.
Yeah, it's available to our subscribers and those who support us on Patreon. Rana, stick around. We're going to continue this on the overtime.
Awesome.
Today's episode of Hidden Forces was recorded at Creative Media Design Studio in New York City. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.